pull this trick again, stop the vote, certify Trump winner.
And actually, it was our local congressman from up here in the Capital District, John Sweeney, who was sent down by the Republicans to Florida to lead the riot out in front of the Miami Board of Elections to stop the recount.
And that's what I'm worried about is violence. Now, in that case, it was kind of semi-violence. You had a congressman, you had consultants and lawyers breaking into the Miami-Dade County Clerk's office and creating mayhem. People were scared to continue counting the ballots, so they stopped. Therefore, Bush was declared president by just 537 votes. And I'm afraid that this time, Roger Stone directed that riot, and he's back with his Boogaloo Boys, and he's a member of the Proud Boys. This time, that was called the Brooks Brothers riot. I don't think they're going to be wearing Brooks Brothers suits this time. You see these guys, go to gregpalace.com, and you'll see the guys wearing their Boogaloo Hawaiian shirts. There's a Nazi swastikas tattooed on their chests, I kid you not. And their Confederate flags, and most important, their AK-15. So, you know, it's I'm very concerned about violence.
Okay. Well, we want to thank Greg Palace for joining us. He is the author of How Trump Stole 2020, The Hunt for America's Vanished Voters. People can go to gregpalace.com for more information. Greg, any last thing you wanted to add we haven't covered?
No, but go to gregpalace.com to see the updates and follow what's going on. And if there is civil war beginning November 4, go to gregpalace.com for the war reports.
Well, thank you very much. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
In New York's 107th Assembly District, which covers much of Columbia County and Rensselaer County, there are three candidates: incumbent Republican Jake Ashby, Libertarian Charles Senrick, and Democrat Brittany Vogel. Our partner station, WOOC, spoke with Assemblymember Jake Ashby about his campaign.
Assemblymember Ashby, thank you so much for joining me. This is your second time running to represent this district, and I'd love to hear you talk about the accomplishments that you've been able to deliver to the district in the past 2 years that you've been representing us.
Oh, thanks, Corinne. It's great to be on with you, and it's actually the third time that I'm running because I was elected in a special election first. And then that was in 2018, and then the regularly scheduled election in November of 2018 as well. So you feel pretty well connected when you're on that type of pace for campaigning and really trying to get things done. But as far as what we've been able to deliver to the district, I'm really happy and proud. Not only to have delivered funds and programming for education, for roads, for infrastructure, you know, stuff that we've had to really battle over during budget process, that fight continues. I mean, obviously we're still involved in it right now. And unfortunately, what we're facing right now is a state government that is really a one-man show at this point. And I'm not alone in that thinking. Many of my colleagues in the state legislature on both sides of the aisle are anxious to get back to work and really start delivering for our constituents.
You know, you mentioned both sides of the aisle, and one thing that strikes me about this district, and you probably are feeling this keenly as in the lead up to the election, as you go door to door and campaign, is that the district is changing a little bit too. You know, you're running as a Republican, but you've got to appeal to a broad spectrum of people in this area. So tell me a little bit about the conversations that you're having with your constituents about, I don't know, like how polarized our politics are now. How do you, as a Republican assembly member, function in a time where we're so polarized and your district is changing?
It's a great question. And our district is very, very diverse. I mean, we deal with issues and problems in places like Lansingburg and what their school district faces, and having one of the largest transient children populations around in upstate New York, and the needs that they're faced with are vastly different than other school districts and what other families are faced with. So it is an amalgamation. I was fortunate enough to grow up in a house, a duplex on Campbell Avenue with my grandmother, who was a staunch Irish American Democrat, and, you know, a working class family. And my father obviously was a Republican. And, you know, we would have these discussions, and they would have to obviously take a backseat during dinner, right? Where, you know, it would trump, you know, a lot of these issues. But, you know, there is a way to do this. And, you know, I think it's threaded into the American fabric of who we are, because we don't come from a one party outlook. You know, I think diversity is a strength of who we are as a nation and who we are specifically in this district. You know, I'm committed to making that happen. You know, you're absolutely right in that this district is constantly changing the makeup of it. I mean, what we're seeing right now with the outflux of people from New York City coming up to here, it's alarming in some ways, but it's also good in a lot of ways too, because it brings people together. It's an opportunity for us to help each other. It's an opportunity for us to grow.
In what ways is the influx of people from the city to this area alarming?
Well, I think it can be a challenge for some people who have been longstanding residents of the area to see a lot of people from another area come into it. And, you know, that typically you will see in cities, you know, I believe, and, you know, where the population can kind of ebb and flow a little bit more rapidly. But in areas like Columbia County, where it's a largely rural area, you can see a lot of people moving into this area, and where people over there have known their neighbors for a long period of time, and all of a sudden they have many, many new neighbors. No, it's not necessarily alarming in that they're afraid, but it's just, wow, we haven't seen this happen before. So it's something new for them. I think overall it's a good thing. It's something that we should be embracing and really trying to be as productive as we can with it.
Should you retain your seat and come back to Albany, whether that's virtually or in person in January, what are your priorities for the coming year?
Right now, my biggest priority is just going back. The state legislature working together to have a balanced state government. Right now we have the governor really calling a lot of the shots, and the legislature isn't able to weigh in on that. That's my number one priority. Once we get back, there's a lot of work that we have to do. Obviously, financially, the impact that COVID has had on our communities, it's permeated into everything. You know, small businesses have been affected. I author legislation that would provide a $5,000 tax credit to small businesses for the modifications that they've made in response to COVID. I think there's other ways that we can help small businesses draw upon the strengths that they already have. I'm very proud of the veterans legislation that I sponsor and have been able to gain bipartisan support for. There's other veterans legislation that will be forthcoming that I already know we are going to have a lot of support for, and I'm anxious to roll that out.
Is there bipartisan support for the $5,000 tax credit idea? I mean, at a time when the state budget is going to take such a hit, I imagine that could be contentious. I don't know. What's the support like for that?
We've had a lot of bipartisan support. I know that we have several Democrat co-sponsors of that bill, not just my colleagues in upstate, several colleagues from downstate and into the city in Western New York and Central New York. So it's very well-rounded bipartisan support. It's not just regional.
You mentioned the goal is getting back to Albany. What's your prognostication in terms of, you know, is the Capitol going to be open for public participation in the legislative process? Do you envision yourself going back to your office in the Capitol, or are lawmakers really planning for a return virtually? Do you know yet?
You know, I'm hopeful that we have a full return and that it's open to the public, taking the necessary precautions with what we're dealing with right now. I mean, that's my aim. That's what I am pushing for. I go back to my office in Albany a fair amount, and I know that a lot of my colleagues do as well. Even my colleagues from downstate in New York City, I know that they're back as well, and a lot of people are feeling like we need to really get back to the task at hand. I anticipate us going back after the election. I don't know if that will be just virtually like it has been, or if it will be in person. I tend to go back to Albany and be there in person and do it virtually. That's just the way that I prefer. I prefer to do it. So, I mean, you can count on me to be there, whether it's virtually or not.
I only have time for one more question, and I have to ask it. You know, the person at the top of the ticket for your party generates a lot of passion from both sides. And I'm wondering, you know, what can I get you to say about how you think the person at the top of the ticket is going to affect, you know, the down ballot races like yours?
Yeah, I think I appreciate the question and the tact on it as well. And you're absolutely right. You know, in going back to an earlier remark that you had made about, you know, things being polarized and people being divided, you know, at the top of the ticket, we have a very polarizing figure. And but I think that there's a lot of things that people can look to in both candidates really and find common ground. And that's what I'm focused on. You know, I'm not interested in attaching myself and pledging loyalty to someone or something 100% of the time, because I don't think that wins in this endeavor of politics and public service. You know, I think that in order to make this happen, we've talked about things before. We talked about issues and making compromise and finding commonality and finding goals. And if we take that type of attitude where we are going to be uncompromising and we're going to cast people away, then we're not going to accomplish what we set out to. So that's what I'm interested in doing. And, you know, and I have no problem in looking into the beliefs and the goals of polarizing figures that are out there and finding things that we can find common ground on and pushing those and advancing those as much as I can. And I know that my colleagues feel the same way on that. That's what I set out to do and what I aim to do.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your candor and good luck on the campaign trail.
Thank you, Corinne.
Republican Liz Joy is running for the New York 20 congressional district seat, currently held by Democrat Paul Tonko, and spoke to our partner station WOOC about her campaign.
Liz, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You are running to represent the congressional district currently occupied by Paul Tonko. Can you tell me, why do you think that this district needs a leadership change at this moment?
I filed to run for this congressional seat back in April of 2019. And the reason that I did is because I'm the mother of four adult children and a future grandmother. And I was highly concerned at the trajectory that I was seeing at the federal level with the bills that were being passed, continually encroaching on our freedoms, our liberties, the high taxes we were bringing less opportunity into our district here in the Capital Region from the federal level. And I was seeing it at the state level as well with the Democrat legislature. So I filed to run against Paul Tonko so that I can get to Washington and actually bring our Capital Region voices into Washington instead of having Washington continually represented here in the Capital Region.
Can you give me some examples of the freedoms and liberties that you think are being constrained under the current representation, under the current leadership?
Yeah, so one of the things that Paul Tonko is pushing hard on is the $93 trillion Green New Deal, which would effectively wipe out all fossil fuels. It would wipe out the oil industry, the gas industry. It would wipe out the fracking industry, which we haven't even been allowed to have in our state because of the current leadership. It would, in fact, put more taxes on us as upstate New Yorkers. We would be carrying a very heavy financial load personally. We would have to retrofit all of our homes, all of our businesses. It would effectively take 18-wheelers off of the road. That's the plan, to incorporate it with electric vehicles. It's extremely expensive. We can't afford it. And he's heavily pushing for that. He's also heavily pushing for Medicare for All, which is a socialized takeover of our healthcare system. And we have five major hospitals here in the Capital Region. We have Albany Medical Center, we have Saratoga Hospital, St. Peter's, Ellis Medicine, and St. Mary's Hospital. And the thing that is keeping our hospitals afloat right now are the reimbursements by the private health insurance companies that so many of the Capital Region citizens have purchased. I mean, 40% of the Capital Region has private health insurance plans, whether it's CDPHP, Blue Shield of Northeastern New York, MVP, or the Empire Plan, if they're a state worker. And Medicare for All would wipe out all private health insurance, and it would force everybody onto a government plan, which would plummet our hospitals. Again, like the Green New Deal, Medicare for All would increase our taxes, and it would cause us to bring home less. And effectively, it would begin to ration care, because by default, it makes providers government workers. And then the pacemakers, the defibrillators, the hip replacements, knee replacements, you know, all of those things that are afforded right now to people that are senior citizens, they're going to be the hardest hit by this. Because of the rationed care, the government is going to have to dictate who gets what and when. And I don't support that. I believe in choice. I believe that everybody does and should and will have access to good health care. But I don't believe in rationing care, and I don't believe that the government should be taking over health care choices for individuals.
Liz, I hope you don't mind. I just want to challenge you. Under our current system, yeah, I think it's, you know, it is scary to think about rationing care, but right now, our care, and I have private health insurance, and the people making decisions about what's covered under my care are shareholders. You know, they're private companies that are operated by people who are looking to make a profit. And so my health care is being rationed all the time, but it's not by the government, it's by private insurers who want to make a profit.
So are you saying that what you qualify for and what you don't qualify for in that, are you saying that you don't have a choice in what you get to
done? Yeah, no, sure, I have a choice in the insurance company, but every day insurance companies are making decisions about what to cover and what not to cover. So it's, in some ways, you know, I think about it as either private shareholders are making decisions about what they'll cover and what they'll pay for and what they won't, or the government is, but somebody's making that determination.
You know, it's an important point, because that's one of the reasons why I'm standing strong to bring in competition and bring it across the state, to bring more competition into our state, so that there are many different plans to be able to choose from based on what your specific age is, your specific situation, your specific family life. And so that's one of the things that I'm fighting for and standing up for, as well as people being able to have the choice if they would like to bring their elderly parents back onto their plans and keep adult children on their plan longer should they choose to, you know, for people who are in school. I know right now in the Obamacare mandate, you know, they have to get off at the age of 26. I actually don't think that's a good idea. I think people should have the option to pool their family plans to make them larger and have much more choice in what they're purchasing. And it's got to be much more cost effective. One of the ways that we can do that is by bringing in the competition, driving down the cost of pharmaceuticals, which actually is happening. We are bringing that cost down. We need to continue to do it more. And one of the ways that we can do that is by bringing that manufacturing out of China and bringing our pharmaceuticals back here to the United States.
What past experiences or training do you have that make you uniquely qualified to represent this district?
You know, it's funny, I get that question all of the time. And as a matter of fact, the Times Union and the Schenectady Gazette said that I was not qualified to run for Congress. And I actually take their words as a compliment, because I've never been a career politician like my opponent, who's been there for 43 years and never actually had to run a business. He's never raised a family. He's never had to live, you know, paycheck to paycheck. He's never served his country in the military. military as we have. I'm a veteran's wife. I'm a Blue Star mother with a son that's currently active duty fighting for our freedoms. He's not combat, but he's standing up for our country. We've run a business, and we're currently running a business. I'm an author. I'm a real estate agent, and I've been a volunteer in our school, and I've raised 4 children. So I have a lot of experience with everyday life. I know how to balance a budget. I know what it's like to live here, to work here, to try to make a paycheck, keep a business going, and watch my husband try to keep employees and not have to furlough them during a pandemic, all of which my opponent, Paul Tonko, has never had to do and actually never even took a pay cut or offered to take a pay cut during the pandemic while we saw our businesses shut down. We saw people in food lines here in New York, and he basically pulled a Biden and hid in his basement and then passed off all of our votes to Grace Meng, a representative who was going and voting on the 20th district's behalf, and she lives in, you know, out in New York City. So I believe I'm uniquely qualified because I'm not a career politician. I'm a common sense mother of 4 veterans, wife who wants to see my country do well, who wants to see my state do well, who wants to see families bring home more money, have better choices in our healthcare, be able to run our businesses without government infringement, stand up for our religious liberties. So, because right now we're watching governors across the country step in and shut down synagogues. We're watching them shut down houses of worship. And I'm going to stand up for our Constitution. So I believe I'm uniquely qualified, and I think it's an amazing compliment when somebody compares me to a career politician and asks, what have I done? I say to the career politician, what have they done? They've raised our taxes. The Capital Region looks worse than it ever has. The Capital District and the 20th District is not better off than it was for the last 10 years with Paul Tonko in office. Amsterdam is struggling and is about to file bankruptcy. It's in a fiscal crisis and a disaster. Gun violence has gone up. Shootings have gone up. He's been silent on bail reform, completely silent on bail reform. He's calling for the defunding of our police departments. And I will stand up for all of those things. We need to have safety and security back on our streets. We need to stand up for our law enforcement communities and thank our men and women in blue who keep us safe and secure. And I'm going to make sure all of these things happen.
Can I go back to the religious freedom argument that you made a few moments ago? Do you believe that there are public health measures that the government should take to protect vulnerable New Yorkers who seek to gather in large groups? Is there any measure that the government can take to put a limit on large gatherings in a religious context?
Well, maybe the first thing that the government should have done is limited the looking and the rioting and the marches that were happening.
Let's talk
about that, because what you have is a double standard, and it's clear.
And we can address that, but I am actually curious about your viewpoint about congregating for religious reasons in large groups. Do you think that the government can do anything to address those large gatherings?
I believe the government needs to stay out of the religious liberties that are afforded to us in the First Amendment of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And let's talk about the looting. Let's talk about the rioting. Let's talk about the thousands and hundreds of people that continually gathered in New York City and throughout New York State that were stealing and destroying and cutting the brake lines in our police department vehicles, which was happening in New York City. Do you think that anything there should have been done? Or do you think that it should have happened as Mayor de Blasio did and Governor Cuomo, where they asked the police to step back and people's property were destroyed? I mean, we do need to address the fact that these large groups, which were not peaceful, do you think that the coronavirus was spread at all through any of those groups?
Well, if you're asking, there is no evidence that the coronavirus was spread, and that the vast majority of folks who gathered were peaceful protesters.
That's
and
not-
also the police took action and arrested many, many, many demonstrators during that time. So if you're asking me, that's what I know but
3,000 police officers were 3,000 police officers were assaulted since May during this pandemic, with the looting and the rioting. Businesses were destroyed, people's livelihoods were destroyed. And if the government in the state of New York and the Democrat governors are not going to get the looting and the rioting under control that we have seen, they have no business in regulating in any way, shape, or form houses of worship like we are seeing happen in Queens and in Brooklyn.
Interesting.
With the synagogues.
Gotcha. So just to lighten this up a little bit, when you're not running for public office, what do you enjoy doing?
Well, thank you. I was a licensed realtor before that. And so I was in the real estate business and enjoyed it very, very much. I was new to it. I didn't get my license. I gotten it in 2017. So I was brand new. I thought it was very exciting. I love our capital region, and had been an author and had helped other people on their campaigns. So that's really what I was doing and pursuing at that time before I decided to run for office.
You were an author. What did you write?
I wrote a book, How to Be Salt and Light, The Christian's Guide to Voting, specifically geared to the Christian community, helping them to get involved in the voting process across the country. And you may well remember that in 2016, we had the largest evangelical turnout in history for the presidential race.
Got it. So interesting. Well, thank you so much for sharing your views on this race and your candidacy with me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it as well.
We're talking with Michelle Hinchey, who is the Democratic candidate in the 46th Senate District, which includes parts of Albany, Schenectady, and Ulster County, and all of Greene and Montgomery County. I actually knew your father as a state assembly member and congress member, but why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you decided to run?
Sure. Thank you for having me. I mean, honestly, I'm running to help people and to be a strong upstate voice in the Senate majority. You know, I grew up here. I grew up in Saugerties, went to Saugerties High School, which is a public school, and then graduated from the Industrial and Labor Relations School at Cornell in 2009. At a time, unfortunately, not that dissimilar from what I think we're all about to go through, in the sense that it was the last recession. And finding jobs in upstate New York, especially for young people, is hard anyway, which is another reason why I'm running. You know, how do we build and strengthen our communities for the future? How do we make sure that our young people can stay here and stay with their families and in the communities that raised them? And I was fortunate to get a job at that time from an internship that I had that set me off on a 10-year career path in communications, working for technology companies and media companies. But at the end of the day, I always felt like there was a lot more to do and to give back and to be involved. And I think especially now, it's clear that we need more strong upstate voices to make sure that our communities and that our people have a seat at the table, and that the issues that matter to us are reflected in that.
Now, just taking a quick look at your website, I noticed that, you know, healthcare is one of your major concerns. You know, are you a supporter of the New York Health Act, the single payer proposal?
Yeah, well, you know, I saw firsthand just how broken our healthcare system is. My father passed away in 2017. But he was diagnosed originally with frontotemporal degeneration, which is a type of dementia, which for him manifested as effectively word loss and required extensive long-term care. And you could think that as a congressman, he could have some of the best health insurance. And we actually had to sell land to pay for his home care. And if that's what we were facing, what in the world is everybody else facing? You know, we're still dealing with the repercussions of that. And we were fortunate enough that we even had the land that we were able to sell. And so healthcare, I believe, fundamentally is a right, is a human right, and everyone deserves quality, affordable healthcare. I think a single payer plan here in New York State is really exciting. I think if we can do it right, which we can, it provides a blueprint really for the rest of the country. And so I think there's a couple things within the New York Health Act, specifically around long-term care, and also really specifically to work with our unions to make sure that we're making sure that they have the coverage at a quality level that they fought for decades, that we don't diminish that by any means. And there's a couple of sticking points, but we can do that. And if we can make the bill as best as possible and really a blueprint for the rest of the country, that's really exciting.
Now, one of the, you know, big issues locally and actually, I guess, worldwide has been the, COVID-19 crisis and among other concerns that has caused the economy to tank a bit, and it has resulted in a sort of a massive